You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, everyone. I am Martina Cunha, and you're listening to Backstage Talk. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Backstage Talk. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing the creators of a new musical called The Aviatrix. Today, I am with Lily Dawson and Casey O'Neill. So thank you for being here. I am really privileged and honored to have you over. I am going to let you introduce yourself for a bit, and we'll get going.
Thank you so much for having us. We're thrilled to be here. I'm Lily Dawson. I was the book writer and lyricist on The Aviatrix.
And I'm Casey O'Neill, the composer.
Great. First thing I want to know is, have you ever written a musical before?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. We've written quite a few, although this was the first that we wrote with each other.
Yeah.
But we both attended NYU's graduate musical theater writing program in different years. Casey was there first.
I actually graduated right as Lily came in, and that's right when we met, was overlapping there.
Yeah, they like to keep the alumni active with the current students. So at one of those alumni mixer type of events is where we met for the first time.
Well, long story short, we've both written quite a number of musicals at this point. I mean, we had to have written at least one coming out of the program. But since then, we've both been very active in writing not just musicals, but plays and other content as well. So we've got a few under our belts at this point.
That's awesome. Actually, one of the programs I saw when I was going into college was NYU's musical theater writing program, and it's just, wow, it's mind-blowing.
It was a really great experience.
Oh, yeah.
We would both recommend it anyone who's interested. It's really comprehensive.
It is rigorous, but it is incredible.
I went into the program never having written a lyric before. I thought I was a playwright who was going to learn how to be a book writer, and I came out like more confident in my lyrics than I could have ever imagined. I met, 30 other amazing people, not to mention all of the brilliant alumni and faculty who I keep in touch with to this day.
Yeah, and I went in not knowing what on earth Scansion was. I came from a classical trombone performance and film scoring background and decided to jump headfirst into musical theater. I didn't know who Michael John Lacusa was, even though he was one of my teachers. So, that program really intensely just was like, here you are, musical theater.
And you had never seen a William Finn musical.
I didn't know who he was. And I was in his class. And he's like, wait, you don't know my shows? And I was like, no. But you're right.
But you know now, that's the point.
I do, yes.
So when did you start writing together?
So this was our first project together, although we've been together for some time.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, has it been?
It's been almost 5.5 years we've been together.
Yeah, and and we got married a year and a half ago.
And we were trying out a couple ideas for shows. Like right after we got engaged, we did a trip to Alaska and we wanted to write a show based on the town of Skagway, and we just weren't finding the heart of it. And then we had this weird idea about like a neo swing sort of modernized Macbeth thing. And it was fun for a while, but then we,
it didn't hook us.
Yeah. We were having trouble with it. And, to get to the genesis of how we got to the Aviatrix, it was really hot. I mean, it was like 100 or something degrees two summers ago in New York City. And we ended up out on the island hanging out with my family, Long Island, that's where I'm from. And that day we were hanging out with my sister and her kid.
Yeah, and they had the membership to the the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Garden City and invited us to come along. And we were there, you know, we like aviation, but also for the air conditioning. Mm-hmm. We were taking a little tour with one of the guides. And because I'm me and I always ask about feminism, I asked, well, where are the women pilots? They must be here. Mm-hmm. And he had this little twinkle in his eye and he said, oh, just you wait. And he took us over to an exhibit on Harriet Quimby, and they had a mannequin there with her exact purple flying suit next to her Blériot plane. And he told us her story, and I think we had the synchronized mind thing.
It was one of those, like, we know each other well enough that we have these silent conversations with each other, where we can read each other's thoughts as the guy is telling us about Harriet Quimby.
And so without like another word, as soon as he was done, we ran over to the gift shop. We purchased her biography. And that night we were reading it, highlighting it, taking notes. And
the next day, did we write Look Up?
Yeah, we had a song pretty fast.
Yeah, I think the next a version of Look Up back when it was the opening number. And
oh, the show has changed a lot.
Yeah. So that was like July of 2018.
2019.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. 2019 that we started it. So, and then we quickly had a draft done and we were planning to do a reading of that first draft, like April 18th of 2020. And the day we sat down with this new director that we were talking to about directing the reading was the day.
It was the day Broadway shut down.
Yeah. So, and you know, we had heard rumors about everything maybe shutting down. We had this meeting like going like, are we going to meet? Probably. It'll be fine. It'll be 2 weeks. You know, and then of course that got postponed to June and then got postponed indefinitely. And, at which point we were just like, you know, we got to do something with this, which inevitably led to what we ended up producing.
That is an awesome story about how everything started. And I love that you two have this silent language between you two. And as soon as this guide in the museum started talking about Harriet Quimby, you both, I can imagine, I can picture it in my mind. Like you both stare at each other and like did like a little smirk. And you both knew that this was going to be your next project. I mean, that is really awesome.
I think we both, when he was telling us about how she was such an inspirational figure, not only in aviation, but to women, and we saw how high she rose in her career and then so tragically died young. And there was so much irony woven into the story and almost like fate. It felt like was written into the story inherently. It was just like, how have we not heard this before?
Not only that, Casey has like a history of writing about air and space, and I have a history about writing about feminist figures.
So it seemed obvious.
Yeah.
it was meant to be. I mean, the two of you were meant to write this show. I mean, I'm starstruck about it. It's like the perfect destiny and universe conspiring for you two to write this. Mm-hmm. So what does the story cover? Because I know I've seen on your Instagram that you have a lot in the of performers in the cast, mm-hmm. mostly women. So I guess it's not only the story of Harriet.
Well, the protagonist of the story is Harriet. And you're right that there are a lot of women in the cast. It's an all femme presenting cast of seven women. This show's mainly about Harriet, but also a significant character is Mathilde Moissant, who was Harriet's best friend and also the second woman to get her pilot's license in the United States. She's also amazing. And the more we learned about her, the more we were like, oh, what more detail can we add in about her? She went from a supporting character to almost a dual protagonist by the end of this current draft.
Mm-hmm. And may even go further further draft.
We have more plans for her, perhaps, in the next draft. Of course, so brilliantly portrayed by Holly Gould.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I could.
They're amazing. Yeah.
Everyone in the cast is amazing. But pretty much everybody is playing somebody that actually existed mm-hmm. in real life.
With the exception of the muses, of course. They're a storytelling device, but yes, everyone else.
They also play some real people.
Yes, this is true.
We have three muse who are sort of ensemble characters who play many different roles. And they each play a lot of roles, and they each had their kind of path. And we tracked them specifically, and we thought a lot about who mm-hmm. would play what role.
I mean, they're covering a bunch of other real pilots that were around back then. The adjudicators for the pilot's exam. They cover the man who created the purple flying suit, even though Harriet designed it. We have the
reporters.
Yeah, the VinFizz representative. All people who were either exactly real or are estimations of the exact real people.
It's actually interesting. Like the history of it all is so fascinating. And the thing about writing a musical based on real life is that there's always so many juicy historical goodies mm-hmm. in there, and you don't want to lose any of it, but you also want to have a streamlined narrative that makes sense, it's clear, and tells the truth underneath the truth.
Oh, yeah.
So that was very difficult because I found every single piece of it fascinating.
And so did so many members of our team, and they were just like, we don't want to lose this. This part's so cool. And we were like, yes, it is. There's no room for it anymore, though.
So in addition to being the first woman in America to get her pilot's license and the first woman in the world to fly across the English Channel, Harriet Quimby was also a really successful reporter. And we were able to include a lot of that side of her life in it. But before that, she had a whole, like, years in Hollywood, and mm-hmm. She, you know, wrote a bunch of screenplays.
She was the first woman credited to write screenplays.
And grew up starting, like, on a farm, you know, with her mother. And we tried to include little bits of historical nuggets mm-hmm. when we could, but it almost, like, it hurt to lose anything because everything she did was its own musical. You know? But it was incredible. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, you mentioned the VinFizz.
Yeah.
VinFizz was a product by Armour & Company, who were one of the first innovators in marketing and were doing, you know, they had their VinFizz flyer where they were one of the first companies to ever do aerial marketing. And that is its own juicy history mm-hmm. and how that was intertwined. And it could only just be a small part of our show.
And I think they were one of the first companies to use sponsors. Mm-hmm. So to have someone who's a big public figure being your sponsor, and I think that technically made Harriet the first female sponsor for a company or first mm-hmm. female spokesperson.
Don't quote us on that.
We have to double check that. But I do think that that's the case. But to sort of to circle around, what does the story cover? It is essentially the last 2 years of Harriet's life, which are the 2 years in which she flew, and she did so much in those 2 years, but it was only, I think it was just slightly under 2 years. She moves to New York, gets her big time journalism gig at Leslie's Illustrated, and she makes a big splash there, but by doing that job, she accidentally gets introduced to aviation. She went to the very first aviation show out in California, and that's where she fell in love with the sport, and then she met Mathilde Moisant, and then she met Mathilde's brother, John, who was one of the leading aviators of the day. They literally called him King of the Aviators, and she coerced him to let herself and Mathilde take flying lessons at their school out on Long Island.
Right, because the Wright brothers weren't allowing women into their school mm-hmm. at the time.
So that's pretty much where our story starts, and it covers her rise and her achievements and her failures throughout that time into when she eventually gets her pilot's license. She becomes a national star, and ironically, an inspiration for feminists across the nation and suffragettes, even though she didn't really mean to be.
She was vocal about that she wasn't a feminist.
Yeah.
So
that was, it's one of those interesting things that, like, we really wanted to write into the show because it's so cool and so interesting. And she was a great feminist icon, and we need more of those even today. But, you know, she was vocal about how she wasn't a feminist. And then we just didn't have room in the show for that, based on the story we wanted to tell. So we follow her trajectory, rising into career. But also, what's just as important, if not more important, throughout the whole show is her relationship with Mathilde, who was really, from what we have learned, they were bosom buddies. And they kind of had this falling out from when Mathilde, the longer she flew, the more she realized that one day this guy was going to claim her. And that was really the fate of all pilots who flew long enough, including her brother, John. And so we see that in the show. And eventually, you know, Mathilde has an accident, decides she's not going to fly anymore, and tries to convince Harriet to not fly. But Harriet is so taken by this adventure in her life that she continues to do it until it's too late.
Mathilde, on the other hand, she lived a long life, mm-hmm. And didn't fly again until World War One. I think World War One.
It was one of the World Wars. I don't remember, but she flew medical planes.
Yeah, where she flew medical planes, and that was the last time she flew. Mm-hmm. She lived into her 80s.
That is a lot to cover, and it's. I mean, it has so many twists and turns, and a lot of characters that I can't imagine how difficult it was to decide what parts of the story fit mm-hmm. in. It's like making a puzzle. I really do like to concentrate on that part, because you both have spoken that you want to portray the story as this feminist icon, even though she, Harriet Quimby, didn't identify herself as a feminist, because she is an icon without a doubt. And even if she wanted to or not to be one, she is. Was that difficult into the writing of the character? Like deciding what happened in real life and what your aims as writers were?
Well, what's very interesting about Harriet, because what we were taken with most when we first were introduced to her was how much she did. And how everyone loved her, how she was beautiful and charming, and it seemingly nothing could stop her. And what we were searching for was some conflict with that, because it seemed like everything she wanted to do, she accomplished with practically no challenge. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, it's not interesting to see a paragon on stage. And we knew there must be some conflict there. Because there has to be. And so we looked within her, and that's where we really discovered the theme of the show, which is, what would you sacrifice for your dreams? You know, what are you giving up by going for all that? With the feminist thing, I think if she lived today, she would identify as feminist. The movement has grown and changed so much since then, and society has changed and accepted terms differently mm-hmm. than they did then. But we did include one quote in the show that I really like, when she said, "Flying is easier than voting," because at the time women didn't have the vote, but she had gotten her pilot's license.
That's harsh. That is harsh.
Oh. Yeah. I would just add to that, you know, I think we ultimately decided, whether it was conscious or not, that we needed to find ways to show how much of an amazing feminist icon she was, despite how she felt, as opposed to telling people she was. Mm-hmm. And you know, we didn't have to write a story. We didn't have to write a plot around her iconicism, if that's the term, around her iconness as a woman leading in a field that in multiple fields that men dominated.
And still do.
Yeah, and just showing her doing it, I think, was enough. And we didn't need to waste any structural areas in the show on telling you something that you could just perceive through the rest of the story. And I think we did a good job of that. And I think that she's an inspirational character, regardless of the fact of how much we leaned on that theme.
Yeah, we went back and forth on how much misogyny to actually show, to portray in the show. And I think we struck a good balance with it. Mm-hmm. It's there, but it's not like you're seeing the patriarchy over and over again. Mm-hmm. And one important thing, I think, decision we made was to cast an all femme presenting cast really puts the story in the hands of women, takes it away from the patriarchy.
Yeah.
I honestly want to see the show. Like, I want to know more about it. I want to see it produced. I need a cast recording. I need to dive in into this.
Gosh, so do we. Let's get this pandemic over.
How was the writing and composing process?
Yeah.
Because you've got a lot of information, so you had to cut, I guess, big chunks of literal history to fit them in into a maybe 2.5-hour show.
I mean, so much. We could have written probably 6 musicals out of the amount of content that her life provided. And even though the information on her out there is slim relative to other historical figures, it was enough that we could say, this is amazing, this is amazing, this is amazing, this is amazing, over the course of her 38 years, and then be able to do our own interpretation and to tell our to focus on her story in a way that we feel we can tell it. So it was like just that perfect balance. There wasn't too much and there wasn't too little. But to find the focus, I mean, we really thought about what is our theme, what are the concepts that we were trying to tell, and then we decided what the beats in her life were that helped tell that story. And
yeah, we wrote a lot of songs while we were figuring that out. We like to joke that we could fill a second musical with the amount of songs we cut and rewrote.
It's less of a joke and just more of a statistic.
It's just reality.
I think we had something like 18 cut songs from between draft 1 and draft 2.
And there were, what, 22 songs in the show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
But it was basically like we wrote to figure it out. And we have a giant whiteboard filled with song titles and lists of things that we wanted to go back to.
I highly recommend whiteboarding. It is just, it is the fiber of musical theater writing.
And I feel really fortunate to be able to work with Casey as a composer who's really loves to contribute to the story, because I am a book writer who doesn't like to do it by myself.
I don't know that she's lucky.
I thrive in the collaboration and having somebody to really talk about.
This amazing woman puts up with me so much, and my obsessive watching of videos on story structure and plot and character writing between Dan Harmon and Brandon Sanderson. It's just constant.
But that was where we unlocked this second draft.
Yeah.
Because we were struggling. We were like, this doesn't feel like it's really fulfilling by the end. And like, we know these are the beats we want. How do we get there? Mm-hmm. And it was just something you said about, oh, these are all the correct beats, but they're just, you know, one off. They're one too early on the story circle.
The story circle, yeah.
And if we just shifted everything over a little bit, we're going to get to the heart of it.
Yeah.
I think that was the same conversation where we had the crazy idea to put on a socially distant movie musical.
Oh. So. Both of these things are my fault. My fault.
Don't apologize. It was a crazy time and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah. I was just going to expound on process. I don't know if that's interesting, but obviously we live together, we're married, and so constantly writing together and being at home all the time at the height of the pandemic, or at least at the height of lockdowns, was just an opportunity for us to stay incredibly motivated and to keep writing, and to say, all right, well, we hit this beat, and what are the next beats that we want to hit? And then we would just make a checklist, and we would just go bang, and knock them off. And then, you know, once we brought some members of our team on board, like our director, Ellie,
Ellie was at script meetings with us once a week.
Yeah, that was extra motivation to continue,
you had to have
something
to show her at the meeting, so it was definitely a motivation.
And I'd say there was maybe an even amount of you writing first and me writing first.
Yeah, there were actually quite a few music first moments. I like a music first. I find the song tends to be catchier that way.
I think I do my better work if I'm just kind of like tossing stuff without an ambition onto the page, and then just being like, hey, Lily, can you put words on this?
Yeah. I mean, as a lyricist, I work best, I think, when there's at least a seed of song, when there's something I can listen to in my head to write to.
And what does the musical sound like?
It's an excellent question. I've been struggling with this question, which is not what a composer of a musical should struggle with, because I'm supposed to be able to say, well, it's this meets this, you know, in an elevator pitch, but it's definitely the most different thing I've ever written. Like, I come from a classical background, and a lot of my stuff has been highly influenced by that and by the jazz in my background as well. So the last two musicals I wrote before this, Cat Massacre was The Great Cat Massacre, that I wrote with Greg Moss. We co-wrote everything. It was very jazzy, very sort of lived in that weird area of like Little Shop and You're in Town and those strange little musicals that have fun, punchy, maybe jazzy scores, but also contemporary musical theater. And then, you know, Danny and the Rocket was kind of this ethereal show in a lot of ways, but also had some fun contemporary musical theater. This one, I don't know.
Well, I think you can see all of that in there, but also a strong influence of pop, because you started getting into pop music in the last like 2 years.
Yeah, way late in the game. I mean, I just started listening to
like 80s and 90s pop.
I just started listening to Avril Lavigne, you know?
And he'd have him on all the time. And I think you can see that in a lot of the songs, which I think is actually really refreshing. But then you also have songs like the Aviator Hymn, which really ring true to where you came from.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely straight out.
It's like a choral piece. Mm-hmm. So it's a great variety. Eclectic contemporary is maybe the...
A big mashup.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do feel like there's
a
general unifying sound, and when it dips out of that, I feel like it is for dramatic purposes, like the Aviator Hymn, this song that they can sing at a funeral or to sing about this thing that they love so much. But you know, also dips into my jazz roots as well in some areas, but you know, in a slightly more contemporary pop-ish way.
It sounds nice, like all mixed up. I want to now dive in into the production you're having.
Mm-hmm.
With all the pandemic going on, where is the musical headed?
So this production that we did is something so unique, and it's something that never would have happened had we not been in a pandemic. And not been the scrappy people that we are that can't stand to sit still. And, you know, it was a lot of stuff to figure out, like how to make people look like they're in the same room when people live all across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And how to get people to record. We had like four different software programs open at any given time.
Oh, yeah.
And we were all figuring it out. And all the actors had to be their own stage crew.
And technicians.
And we all had to learn it really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we worked with a few film editors who put it together.
And our sound designer as well.
And our sound designer. We worked with some film people, which was interesting. That was new. Mixed with theater people, which was kind of like a shared language.
Yeah.
I'm really, really proud of the product we put together.
Mm-hmm.
It was like 6 to 9 months, I think, of eating 3-4 times a week to try to like work out these, you know, do we use lavalier mics? Do we use handheld mics? Do we do earbuds? No earbuds.
Yeah. Do we do boxes on screen, or do we use green screens and merge everyone into the same room? Yeah. And that, those were all hours long conversations, or, you know, conversations that, that lasted weeks, or, you know, a couple months sometimes, but basically from August 1st until the end of January was just a wild ride of rapid and aggressive collaboration between, God, how many people were on this show? Did we end up hitting 20?
Probably.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's, I mean, if you include the cast, definitely.
Oh, definitely if we include the cast. But, like, the crew...
at least 15.
And I think it grew a little bit as we went, as we took on some additional help in certain areas. And yeah, we definitely beat a dozen and a half, I think.
And the production was, like, nothing I've seen yet in the pandemic, or, you know, ever, because it's not something people would think to do. You wouldn't think to just film everybody remotely and then... green screen them together. Mm-hmm. if we didn't have to, but it is something really unique and different, and I'm very proud of the product that we have.
Yeah.
It aired, you know, at the end of January on Vimeo. We're, you know, looking into what we can do next.
Yeah.
We had to take a breather.
It was very intense towards the end. There was a lot of, you know, we were a small scrappy crew. And we all were wearing like 6 different hats. And I think I spent the week before, no, the 3 weeks before the airing, just constantly on my computer doing mixing, orchestrating, and mastering. Not in that order, but it was just very intense. And, you know, our editors were also editing at the same time that I was doing that. And our sound designer was also fixing up all of the audio at the same time. And we were all just sort of like, I'm done with this here. I'm passing it to you. And it was constantly just gears turning all hours.
I learned how to do Photoshop so that I could do graphics on social media, which is something I had never done before, just to help out help out Becky and Ellie, who were also wearing 6 other hats. And they were just like, we have to get these things done and we don't have enough hours in the day. Mm-hmm. You know, plus everyone has a day job, of course. So
yeah.
It's when are we getting everything done? There was quite a few all-nighters pulled in the last 3 weeks.
Can people still see it?
At the moment, no. We are working on what we can do to show it to people again. We're not sure what that means or what we will do. Ideally, there'll be something in the future. We don't know yet.
We don't know yet what it is. It will be something. We are not done with the aviatrix.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll just have to figure out what it looks like next.
Mm-hmm.
We 100%, and one of the major things that we heard from people was, we love this so much. I really want to see it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we sorely want to see as well. And so we'll be working our butts off to get that to happen, so that it's completely ready to go when we're back.
Yeah.
So we're ready, like packaged up, and let's get it out there.
Yeah. I also would love to, like, I mean, of course, I'm so proud of the whole process, but particularly as a composer, I'm really, really proud of the work that we did on the score. And would love to be able to showcase that in a way on its own. So I don't know what that looks like yet. There have been a couple of people who have asked about doing a cast album. So far, that's not in the cards because it wasn't a part of the original plan. And so that is something that we would have to just talk about and work out and, you know, see how people are feeling about that. Just because, you know, we never talked about it. But I would love to do something with that because I think
these actors sound incredible.
Mm-hmm. They really put their all into it and they sound so great.
Well, hopefully the pandemic will be over soon now that vaccination is going on globally. I just read that today, theaters in Australia are opening back up. So that is a light in at the end of the tunnel. So yeah, I really, really want to see this fully produced, either it's virtually or in a type of pro shot or on the stage, because I think that the message you two have created is very powerful, and it has, it is a statement that we need right now.
And well, thank you. So, yeah.
Before we say our goodbyes, where can people find you and support the Aviatrix?
Yeah, so we have a website, www.theaviatrixmusical.com, and you know, it's currently up to date with all the stuff that we did with this most recent production, and it will lead you to our Facebook and our Instagram. What's our Instagram handle?
I believe we're at Aviatrix Musical on Instagram and Twitter.
We're also on TikTok.
And yes, we're on TikTok. I don't know our handle for TikTok.
No, I don't either.
I think if you Google the Aviatrix Musical, you'll be able to find all these things.
I don't think we're young enough to understand TikTok. We've crossed that threshold. we will be putting out some stuff, you know, be it big or small, in the near and distant future. So you can look out for that. There's also some, we've got one video up on 10 Glow as well.
Yes. Yes,
Lily was just
started a 10 Glow for myself. It's a very new social media platform for musical theater specifically. So I thought, why not jump on that train?
And she was featured as
yes.
one of their lyricists on the website. So you can check out our song Lady Bird on there, sung by Tanisha Moore, who played Harriet in the show.
Oh, and did she play Harriet? She sang that part brilliantly.
Oh, yeah.
Could not have asked for a better. She shines as Harriet.
I particularly love that cut that we did with her in the video. It just that one really. I mean, the one she did in the film as well is incredible. But
yeah, that song is around on social media, and you should definitely watch it. But yeah, they did a deep dive into the lyrics on that, which was really, really cool.
Yeah,
that is awesome. I'll be sure to add every handle, link, and everything to lead people your way. One last question before we go. A no-brainer for you two. Top 5 favorite musical theater shows.
Ooh.
Oh my gosh. I'm so basic when it comes to musical theater. My favorite musical of all time is Wicked. Huge fan. I also, I'm a big fan of the team Aarons and Flaherty. They are my idols. So I particularly love Once on This Island and Seussical, which I grew up with. Oh gosh, I love every musical. I love every musical.
And you know so many that I'm just like, I've never heard of that.
Gosh, what is your favorite?
Well, Hamilton is definitely my favorite. I am going to be a basic bitch. Hamilton is my favorite. And, you know, I do find that funny considering my history and my background in classical music. I spent years of my life only listening to Mahler, Strauss, and Beethoven, and Mozart.
And there's no hip-hop in this show.
Yeah. So, but Hamilton, hands down, is my favorite. And then beyond that, I'm going to try and not dwell on minutia as to which one is better or not, but like it's basically the M's. It's like Les Mis, Book of Mormon. I used to count Music Man up there, but I think recently I've discovered some other ones that I like more.
A soft spot for the Music Man,
and
it's very nostalgic for me.
Like I've recently come to really love the cast album for Curtains and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Such hidden gems.
Yeah. Oh, Hadestown.
Oh,
yeah,
I mean, Hadestown.
Damn, that show is amazing.
Yeah, you didn't know any musical theater when you came into NYU.
Mm-hmm. I knew a little bit. I knew the basic stuff.
Yeah. I've been a musical theater nerd my whole life. I haven't listened to any other types of music besides musical theater. People say pop singers, and I don't know who they are.
Yeah, same with me. Don't worry about that.
I'm also like really into The Prom lately. I've been really enjoying that, and that was one where I went in being like, all right, I know what the flavor is, and like it won't be bad, but I don't think I'll be super into it. And then I came out of that show like, yes. So,
I like that songwriting team also, because they wrote The Wedding Singer, which was another show I loved. Mm.
Well, thank you so much for being over. And I cannot wait for everything that's to come for your musical and any other production that you're working on.
Oh, yes. Cross your fingers that we make it through this and that we can see the Aviatrix live on stage.
Yeah.
Yes, I know it will. So thank you so much and hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of Backstage Talk. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Backstage Talk Podcast.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.